coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And if you see something that you just simply can't identify, if you have a computer, it's UFOCenter.com. And then Peter Davenport's phone number to report other strange sightings, 206-722-3000. So you can call and leave a message and get recorded. He always likes to record your statements for posterity and also for Coast to Coast AM. In a moment, we're going live to the United Kingdom. Lionel Fanthrope, my guest, as we're going to talk about creatures, monsters, and strange things on planet Earth. Lionel Fanthrope was born in England and has worked as a journalist and teacher. He is currently Director of Media Studies at Cardiff Academy and is a fully ordained Anglican priest working part-time and unpaid for the church in Wales. Lionel is also president of the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. He's also president of the British UFO Research Association. He's now a popular TV and radio presenter and celebrity guest on chat shows. Lionel is also the author of more than 250 books. And he is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Lionel, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, George. Lovely to hear from you, and thank you for the great introduction, sir.
And Anglican priest. I've always had trouble with that word.
Well, I think probably if we said Episcopal, or we call it the Church of England, we very rarely say Anglican ourselves because it's a troublesome word.
From now on, the Church of England is the way it will be.
Thank you.
What have you been up to since we last talked some time ago?
Well, we've been working on the latest book, which is called Unsolved Mysteries of the Sea, and in connection with that, we went over to Hawaii, well, particularly to the smaller island of Kauai, and there we met a very, very fine guy, David Richard, who swims with dolphins and communicates with dolphins. He has tremendous faith in the idea of dolphin intelligence, and he thinks they maybe have a lot to teach us.
Oh, I think you are absolutely right, and he is too. And by the way, I looked on our website, coasttocoastam.com, and there's a great picture that we've got of you. You're in movies too, huh?
Yeah, well, we do we do a lot of television stuff. The last movie I was in was called The Magnificent Handshake, and I was playing the part of the father of a young lady who was a job seeker, and I'm a weight training instructor as well, so some of my friends politely call me Schwarzenegger with wrinkles. And I've never given it up in spite of the passing of time. So I was playing the part of the girl's dad, and he was he was aging, but he was still a muscle man. And as he was having his breakfast, he was still doing his barbells with one hand. And the kid was saying, "Dad, how do I get this job interview? How do I get the job when I go for the interview?" And all he could say was, "It's all in the handshake, kid. Give him a great handshake." Anyway, cutting the story short, she tries in the gym. She can't build muscles like Dad, but she eventually makes herself a bionic overlay for her arm and puts it on like a glove and gives the interviewing president such a handshake that she nearly breaks his fingers. And they take her on as the executive in charge of stapling and undoing ink bottles.
You know, I don't know if you had an opportunity to see the story and picture of this unbelievable event in Taiwan today. A few weeks ago, a 60-ton whale beached itself, and that's sad enough. And they were trucking the carcass of the whale, Lionel, through Taipei. The gases inside the whale erupted. The entire body blew up.
Wow.
And there were pieces of this whale all over the town, everywhere.
Wow.
And they're still cleaning it up. It's been about 12 hours now.
No, I haven't seen the picture yet, George, but it brings back a story. And I must just tell you this one. When I was a small boy, my father used to tell me little stories about when he was a boy, and he was so much older than me, because I was the eldest son of his second marriage, that he remembered Victorian times. His first job had been as I think what you would, we call them undertakers or funeral directors. I think they're morticians in the USA.
Yes, is that yes, right? Yes, they are.
And so if you can imagine a 14-year-old boy working for a mortician, this is before the turn of the previous century, so we're back to about 1894, 1895. He is sent out by himself with a pony and trap, little cart, and told to go to a home for, maybe we'd call them paupers, or the, you know, the poor guys who had nowhere else to go when they were old and too old to work, kind of stayed home for them. Conditions were very Spartan. He was told to pick up the body of one of these poor old gentlemen who had passed over, all by himself, in the night. He's going back on this pony and cart over a dirt road, and as they went over a rut, the body in the casket behind him loses wind at both ends. And he says, hey, the guy's alive, the guy's alive. Imagine you're a 14-year-old kid with what you think is a recovering dead body in the back of a car. So he gallops back to grandfather's house. Grandfather sticks his head out of the window and says, what do you got there, son? It's a dead body, Dad. Take it out. I don't want it here. It's bad luck. So he said, even my father turned me away.
Kid would never be the same again.
He lived to be 84. He was a great dad, so he must have recovered somehow.
You are one of the greatest storytellers I have ever chatted with, by the way.
Oh, George, I thank you for that. It's a lovely compliment, sir. And I love being on your show. Thank you so much for inviting me back to be with you.
Sea serpents, huh?
Yeah, indeed. That's one of the chapters in the new book that Patricia and I have been working on, and it's actually going to be chapter 4 of The Unsolved Mysteries of the Sea, which is coming out from the Dundurn Group, who are up in Toronto in Canada. So we have friends in the USA who kindly publish our books, and we have those are Red Wheel Wiser. They've got one coming out shortly, and we also said have good friends up in Canada in Toronto. And the chapter on sea monsters, I start off that chapter, or Patricia and I start off that chapter, going right back to the early Greek poetry, because accounts of sea monsters are very old indeed. And Oppian, who was a Greek poet, wrote a marvelous book on fishing, and he called it in Greek Haliutica. And in the book, he warned fishermen against the monsters that he said would appear off the Iberian Sea, off the coast of Spain. And they were called Ketia. That's K-E-T-E-A, Ketia in Greek. And they're frequently described as very elongated, kind of serpentine things, much longer than ordinary fish. And one of the most intriguing stories about them concerned the great Greek emperor, Macedonian Alexander the Great. And he was said to have been, although of course it over 2,000 years ago, it's difficult to get the evidence of the kind that you and I like on our Unsolved Mysteries, but there are very interesting reports that Alexander, who was an explorer and conqueror of the sea, as well as of the land, had a huge glass diving bell built. Now, when you think of how primitive glass was in those days,
oh my gosh.
I only hope it was, you know, the world is fortunate that it was strong enough to hold the great emperor safely.
You wouldn't get me in that thing.
No, I would want a very modern one with plexi steel and the kind of stuff that we put into the space service. Yeah,
about 6 inches thick.
At least, George, I'm with you. And Alexander went down in this, and he, it was said, saw a sea monster so vast, so enormous, that it took 3 days to pass him. So we can make of that whatever we wish, but those are two of the classical accounts of the early sea monsters. And then got another very, very up-to-date. We were asked by BBC television here in the UK to go over to a place called Pembroke Dock, which is on the Welsh coast looking out towards Ireland.
Okay.
And there we interviewed the eyewitnesses, who were very sensible, very, very nice people. And they, four of them, had seen within a moment or so of each other a thing they described as 5 cars long and about as far across as a good beer keg. Now, I'm not quite sure how USA beer kegs compare with ours, but a good beer keg here, a big one, would be about as wide as my office desk.
They're not that big.
Yeah. And so we've got a thing 5 cars long, which is about, shall we say, from the tip of your nose to your arm fully stretched. Like a good old bowman would have pulled the string back when he was releasing
mm-hmm.
an arrow.
As far as he could.
Yeah, as far as he could.
Okay.
And so that's given us the girth of the brute. And it sounded pretty genuine to us. So with the BBC funding behind us, we hired a boat called the Cledi King. And with the skipper, Alan Lewis, who got wonderful high-tech stuff in that boat, we went all the way down the Pembroke Channel. And, of course, we didn't see anything of it, but he had all the sonar equipment going and all the radar going, and it was great fun watching the screens and just hoping that the Pembroke beast that had been seen by the other witnesses would turn up for our BBC camera. Unfortunately, all we were able to film was the, a few shoals of fish going under the boat showing up on sonar. But I trusted the witnesses. They were very, very sensible people, and maybe if you'd like me to in a couple of minutes, I could read you one of their accounts.
Oh, absolutely. Wouldn't that have been an event had you been able to capture some of that on film or video?
Got him filmed. But it's always, when you go on expeditions like that, it's like the sad old story of too little, too late.
Now, these sea monsters are not to be confused with Nessie, or are they?
Well, Nessie is very, very interesting indeed, because Nessie is one of the monsters that could have been a sea monster herself, because at one time Loch Ness seems to have been, our geologist and marine geology friends would tell us that Loch Ness was at one time connected to the North Sea, and the reports of her go back to 565, when St. Columba was around. So we're looking at the 6th century, and this is long before anybody could say, hey, these guys are doing it for publicity, because
right.
One of the accusations is that local hoteliers and local business people encourage stories of sightings just so that they can get a few more tourists to the area. But in 565, there was no tourist trade in Loch Ness. But St. Columba was traveling up to Inverness on a missionary journey to the Picts, and he rescued a man who was in danger on Loch Ness. And there's an original account of this which says, a strange beast rose from the water. And the geological history of the loch, as we said, it could well have been connected to the sea, which would mean that we might have had something in the plesiosaur family. Anyway, what happened was that the swimmer who was in trouble shouted for help. He saw this thing coming towards him, and Columba himself ran fearlessly into the water, because these old saints were pretty muscular guys. They had to be to survive. And Columba runs into the water to save his friend, and he shouted to the monster, and these are the words of the original report, "Go no farther. Touch not thou that man." Now, as we know, Columba was a pretty powerful man in mind and body, as well as a good and courageous man. So whether it was his loud voice or whether he had a paranormal power of holiness, but the monster decided that he'd more than met his match. He wasn't going to tangle with Columba. And he disappeared, and Columba saved the guy's life.
Probably thought the guy was nuts. He didn't want anything to do with the person.
Yeah, yeah. And other accounts, I've got a little list here that goes right over the years. If we jump up to what we call modern history, 1895, several fishermen and timber workers reported seeing something, their words, very big and horrible, surfacing not far from them in Loch Ness. In 1903, three witnesses in a rowing boat saw him, and they actually tried to get closer. I think I'd have been rowing the other way. In 1908, a witness called John McLeod saw something which he said was 12 meters long, with a body like a huge eel. In 1923, we jump another 10 years, two guys called Miller and McGillivray saw it. In 29, a lady named Mrs. Cummings and another witness saw this humped creature on the surface. We go up to 1930. Ian Milne saw something inexplicable in the lock. He said it was swimming at 20 knots. In 1943, we're in World War II, something 10 meters long, also observed, and then it submerged, but was clearly discernible below the surface. In 1947, the MacIver family and some friends who were with them reported it. In 1953, timber cutters working beside the lock reported seeing it for two or three full minutes. And so it goes on. In 1954, it got picked up on an echo sounder. In 1960, and this is a really spooky report, Torquil MacLeod and his wife saw it while they were near Invermorriston. They had it in view for 10 minutes, and they described it as grey, with skin like an elephant or a hippopotamus. And then a big group of guests in the 60s saw it for a clear 5 or 6 minutes. And then there's the famous story about Sir Peter Scott, you know, the son of the famous polar Antarctic explorer.
Right.
And Sir Peter founded the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau. And he called it the monster by a rather technical Latin name. He called it Nessiteras rhombopteryx. And when you do a crossword enthusiast's anagram of that, it comes out as Monster Hoax by Sir Peter S.
I remember a long time ago in the National Geographic, Lionel, I saw a picture of what they thought was Nessie,
right,
with one of those plesiosaurus fins. Do you remember that picture?
I do remember that picture, and it looked so convincing, and that came from that bureau, investigation bureau, which Sir Peter set up. He was a guy, sort of a brilliant mind and a wonderful personality, but he had this dry sense of humor, and I think he had the kind of sense of humor, which would love to do the now you see it, now you don't, oh yes you do, it's come back. And so he got the kind of sense of humor which would take a genuine phenomena, pretend for fun it was a hoax, and then produce the real one and says, now who's kidding who?
Exactly. Exactly. There's got to be something out there.
I think there is, yes. I mean, the lock is well over 20 miles long. It's 250 meters deep. We're talking about nearly 1,000 feet deep in some places. And the water is so it's so murky and so dark that you simply can't see more than a few meters. And even with modern electronic equipment, you know, with sonar and radar and all the things that we've got today, it's still rather as if you and I were looking, if we did it as a scale model, if we had an ant and we were in, say, your studio or my office,
right,
which is 4 or 5 yards, or say 20 feet across, and this ant is somewhere between the ceiling and the floor. Now, you can send an awful lot of anteaters into that office space and they wouldn't find him.
Exactly. And, yeah. And you know, there may be a couple of them there, but not a lot.
No, I think that there would have to be, I think, a small colony, just a kind of little breeding colony. And it would need to be something like that. The most recent, you know, to support the idea that you and I have, that there really is something there, and it's just the size of the lock which keeps it from being seen. As recently as last year, 2003, there were witnesses on the Royal Scot, which is one of our famous trains, and it was an early afternoon, and so the guy's sitting in the train as the Royal Scot is moving along not far from the lock, and there they saw the creature. So you've got a trainload of witnesses.
Oh, what a sight that would be. Stay with us, Lionel. We'll be back with you in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast. I'm going to say this one more time. You're an Anglican priest. Ah, see? I said it. Back in a moment. Someone
saw me coming. Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter and reserve your free CD of Art Bell and the late Father Malachi Martin. 888-727-5505. And if you say you want me now, From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Lionel's website, of course, linked up with coasttocoastam.com. If you go to the right-hand side of the screen, the homepage, you'll see his name, and just scroll down just a little bit, and there it will be already linked up. Lex has done it again. After Dark newsletter comes out every month, the February issue on telekinesis. That's just one of the many stories you'll get, but you'll also get a free CD, one of Art Bell's earlier interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin on exorcisms. A couple ways to order. One is toll-free. Operators are there 24 hours a day. 1-888-727-5505, and the other way right off the website, coasttocoastam.com. Lionel Fanthorpe, my guest. I'm George Norrie, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM. There are, though, so many incredible stories of the unknown out there, Lionel. How did you find so many of them? I mean, stories of vampires, reincarnation.
Well, it's one of those things. I think you remember that the famous story by Harriet Beecher Stowe, where little Topsy is asked how she got there, and Topsy says with great presence of mind, "I suppose I just grew." Now, I think this is how the thing started for me. I go right back to a teenage interest in it when I was in school, and I used to sneak off to the library to avoid difficult things like mathematics and Latin grammar. And there I would read the works of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and of course Hugo Gernsback, and some of the other wonderful pioneering the pioneering writers of science fiction and of weird things and anomalous things. And so I thought, hey, this doesn't have to be confined to the pages of good fiction written by highly imaginative and intelligent writers. Maybe it's really out there in the world. So my interest began with the literature of the paranormal, of the psychic, of the supernatural, and of science fiction, and then it went onwards and outwards, and once it became known, as it is in your case, and with your wonderful program, and with your After Dark magazines, once it becomes known that someone is sympathetically interested and is not going to laugh, but is going to listen to a witness, then witnesses come and seek you out, and they say, could you come to see this place that I saw? Or would you come and listen? I heard these strange noises. Or as I was walking along this particular stretch of road, I thought I saw. And then you meet other investigators, and the thing just kind of snowballs. It networks. I think that's probably the best word for it. So this was how we got around to meeting the people in the first place. That's going back right to the early beginnings of it. And then the more you write and the more you broadcast and the more you lecture on the topics that interest you as an impartial, objective investigator, so you find that still more and more and more friends come to you, and you get the opportunities, the invitations to go out and investigate. For instance, when we were over on the island of Kauai, you know, in Hawaii State, just a fortnight ago, we'd gone over to investigate one set of mysteries and myths and legends, and by the time we had met very knowledgeable local citizens like David Richard and some of his friends, we were being shown books and told legends and told mythology. We came across a whole new concept that even after all our 40-plus years of investigating, we'd never heard of before. And this was the legend of the were-shark. And the idea was, just as, you know, the werewolf is found in places like Transylvania, where you'd expect to find Dracula and the vampire legends, because the local people sometimes come to an unfortunate end in dark and lonely places, and the story begins to build up in those dark forests. There are werewolves. And so if you're on an island where sharks are swimming around on the outside, and you have an accident one day when you're fishing and you never come back, so there are legends. Not of the real shark, but also of this were-shark who takes human form by day.
Oh my God.
And when he gets into the water, he resumes his shark form. And one of the strangest legends concerned the king of the sharks, or the king of these were sharks, who was minding his own business, and fortunately for the young lady concerned, was well fed at the time, and he sees the most beautiful girl swimming just above him, and he follows her as she swims, and he is so captivated by her beauty that he doesn't attempt to eat her. He just follows her quietly back to land, and then when she's out of sight, he resumes his human form and is a very attractive, muscular, athletic, handsome bloke. And he then meets the girl, courts her, and marries her. And all the time, he's got this other half of his nature, which is calling him back to the sea. And when she's a good 8 months pregnant, he breaks the bad news to her. He never tells her that he's really a were-shark. He just says, "I'm sorry, my dear, but I have other commitments. My people need me. I must go back to my own place." And he disappears back into the sea, but not before he'd given her certain instructions about the upbringing of their son. And he said, "When the baby's born, he will have a minor abnormality. You must keep that covered. Don't let other people see it." And then he says, "Whatever happens, don't let him eat meat. Bring him up as a vegetarian." Anyway, the baby is duly born, and the young mum notices that he's got a little kind of fissure down his spine. And as he gets older, it develops into a second mouth with shark teeth in the middle of his back, and she makes a little cloak for him, keeps it covered. But of course, the time comes when the boy reaches puberty, and in the tribal tradition, he has to go and eat in the house of the men, where no women are allowed, so he's kind of grown up, right, and he can sit with the other big guys like us. And so, of course, one of them, being kind, friendly, here's the newest member. It's like being the newest member of the fraternity, you see? So you say, "Here you are, son, have some meat, have some fish, and have some chicken." And of course, as soon as he starts eating meat, all his shark characteristics begin to develop. He develops this voracious appetite, and ultimately he takes his friends swimming with him, and only one comes back. So there's the legend of the were-shark, and it's just as an example of how I went out there to talk to Dave Richard, who is the, you know, the dolphin expert, and I then came across this other legend. So you might say that going out in search of one mystery opens the doors to others.
You know, there are so many scary stories I want to talk with you about tonight, but the one story that has me so baffled, Lionel, is the Perry Reese map in the Mystery of Antarctica. That story, that map, has me so puzzled, but I want to get your perspective on that.
Well, that's very, very kind. I'm honored when an investigator with your experience and your very wide knowledge, you know, from other friends that you've interviewed, is kind enough to ask my opinion. I'll give it to you with great pleasure.
Please.
I believe that, as you know, Piri Reis was a Turkish admiral. And he had begun life, strangely enough, as a pirate. He had an uncle who had protected him and who had then become an admiral himself. And for quite a long time, Piri Reis was very successful. He was a very intelligent man, and he was an expert navigator. The problems for him arose at the end of his life when he was then well into his 80s and still commanding the fleet, when something went wrong at a battle, and with maybe an understandable instinct of self-preservation, Piri took his men and drew and came away when his when the emperor had rather intended him to go out and do his best and do or die. And when he got back, he was arrested and executed for more or less coming away from a battle that the powers that be wanted him to go into and win. And we have an old story like that about poor old Admiral Byng, the British Admiral, who failed to do something that the British Admiralty wanted him to do back in the 18th century. And he was hanged for neglect of duty. And Voltaire, the great French humorist, said, "From time to time, the English hang an admiral to encourage the others." And, you know, as Voltaire said, "pour encourager les autres." And the basis of this was what I think was done to poor old Piri Reis, that, it was thought that if even a senior admiral like him could be executed, then the others had better try a bit harder. So what we've got here is a man of great age. I just put that little bit of background in, George, so that we could see the man's age.
Right.
This isn't a brave young sailor with his first command at age 27. This is a guy who has an extensive knowledge.
Seasoned officer.
A very seasoned officer indeed. Excellent. Now, this man has used practical navigation. So the Piri Reis map is something that has been, as it were, justified in practice. It's rather as if you or I were using a particular guide to television, you know, for presenters and producers and directors. If we were using a well-thumbed and well-loved book written by experts in our profession. And so here is a seasoned officer here with a map that has been used. So we're not looking at anything theoretical. We're looking at the practical side of life in what was a very dangerous profession. If you made a mistake, if you were a sea captain in the days of Piri Reis, you didn't live to be an old sea captain like he did. So the man is seasoned, the man is experienced, and the man is, above all, a practical sailor. Now, where did this map come from? That's the great question.
That's the question.
And it seems to have a very long and, shall we say, honorable history. One of the theories is that it was part, at one period, of the great library at Alexandria. And the, you know, the library which was tragically destroyed, taking with it in that conflagration so much of the mysterious knowledge of an ancient world of civilizations and cultures that were around long before our own rise to civilization. And it would seem to me, my own personal view of the Piri Reis map is that it goes back so far, and we have to bring in the question of Atlantis, if Atlantis ever existed, or of some even older culture who were around and were capable of making maps of that quality when the Antarctic continent was clear of ice and could be mapped just as effectively as the coasts of the Mediterranean or the Iberian coast or the East or West African coasts, which were the areas that were, you know, familiar to Piri Reis and his contemporaries. And so we're saying, here we have a map which shows in close detail details of that Antarctic continent which have only recently been, shall we say, rediscovered
by satellite
and by the most up-to-date technology that the 21st century can provide. So I would put myself, rightly or wrongly, and again, I can only weigh up the evidence in the same way that you and our listeners can do it, as objective, open-minded, thinking investigators. A guy has a piece of information which he ought not to have. If it's so accurate it can't be discarded, then where on earth did it come from? My view would be it came either from a much older culture about which we know almost nothing, who were there and making maps before the ice came 10,000, 15,000 years ago, or we may be looking at the extraterrestrial theory that somebody in a wingding of a ship had a good look at that continent with the even better equipment than we've got from satellites, and being a kind-hearted guy, said, I'll help these Earthmen. They seem to be nice guys. They're intelligent. They're developing. And he just dropped his information into the right cartography department at a medieval university.
Because the quality of this map is fantastic.
It is. Yeah, it can't be dismissed. It's the most amazing thing. And again, if I could mention our new book again, The
Absolutely.
Mysteries of the Sea.
Absolutely.
Thanks. There's a whole chapter on it, on the ancient maps and the sea kings. And the theory that we put forward there is basically what you and I have discussed, that it was either a gift from some alien visitor who had the ability to look through ice, or who did his visit before the ice.
Before the ice. Or, like you said, there were Earthlings on this planet a long time before we even thought there were.
Yeah, I think that's the more likely of the two probable explanations, that something like Atlantis or Lemuria had reached a very, very high level of culture. And among the things they did was to cruise down and have a look at what is now Antarctica. Because yet another theory, which was put forward by two excellent researchers called Flem Ath, and they had the idea that the continent had moved, that it had once been in a warmer area, and that there had been a kind of sliding across the soft magma underneath. And Einstein himself and Professor Hapgood both had this idea that if you have, we'll say, something like a baseball, and you had an outside which was firm leather, but inside you had something like silicone, or you had oil, then the outside sphere could slide over the lubricated sphere inside. And that was the Hapgood and Einstein and Flem Ath theory, that the thing, that Atlantis hadn't sunk, it had moved around and become the South Pole when it had once been temperate.
Did Perry Reese ever say where he got the map?
Well, not in so many words, because a lot of these old map makers were very jealous of one another's skills. And, I mean, say that you're in command of one expedition as their admiral, I'm in command of another one, you sail off and find something very exciting, and you've also got an old map. So you add the knowledge from the old map to what you've discovered, and it comes out to your credit, you know, rather like a professor writing a research paper.
Mm-hmm.
Then I sail off with my expedition in another direction, and somebody gives me from the relics of the Alexandrian Library, or from some other very ancient outpost of the old lost civilization, gives me some ancient information, which I put with mine, and we call yours the Norrie map, and we call mine the Fanthorpe map. But both of us have added to our personal discoveries something older. And we keep that source close to the chest, because being human, we like to have a little bit of credit for what we've done and what we've found. And it's a great human characteristic to want to stamp your name on things.
You know, talking about the sea, do you think that the old stories of mermaids and the myths of mermaids might have been because sailors perhaps saw seals or dolphins, and then the stories came? Or do you think there were really mermaids out there?
Well, it's a wonderful question again, George. And again, it's a chapter in the new Unsolved Mysteries of the Sea book. We've investigated this pretty closely. And I think one of the most tenable and practical of all the theories is that, shall we say, love-starved sailors who'd been at sea for a couple of years were perhaps not seeing as clearly as they would if they were looking on Earth. And the dugong, which at some angles from a long distance could be quasi-human, when you get close, you would say to the lady, "No thanks, I've changed my mind about the date."
And run the other way. Sort of like a mirage when you're on a desert. Just the reverse of that, huh?
Exactly. And so the dugong is one of the candidates for mermaidhood. And there's also, I think, the possibility, this links in, and just to digress for a moment, I have a feeling that if only we could get, we, investigators like you and me and our listener friends who are into research, if only we could find all the clues and trace them all back to their origins, we might find that there is a unified field theory that covers the paranormal, just as Einstein looked for a unified field theory to cover all the physical forces. And I think that if we link our mysteries, we can tie in the mermaid legends and the mermaid myth with those stories about sea gods like Oannes or Iar. And we find that there are stories in many ancient religions, and many religions, shall we say, from very old countries.
Mm-hmm. Stay with us, Lionel. We'll be back with you in just a moment. You know, I would listen to you read items off of a menu from a restaurant. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
I fly you around the universe in fireball exo-fire, way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball.
reserve your free CD of Art Bell and Malachi Martin when you subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505.
We cruise along the Milky Way and land upon the moon. Through a wonderland of stardust, we'll zoom our way to Mars. My heart would be a fireball.